It is a considerable increase over missiles we've seen them launch before.
North Korea launches an apparent long-range missile. It's Wednesday, July 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China's financial markets open more. India's prime minister visits Israel. Climbing Pakistan's treacherous K2 mountain. Technology for those without. A holiday for the people. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea on Tuesday said it successfully fired off its first intercontinental ballistic missile. The missile fell inside Japan's exclusive economic zone. The U.S. Pacific Command said its flight duration was 37 minutes with a range of 930 kilometers. One analyst put the altitude at more than 2,800 kilometers. The launch was condemned by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "Perhaps China will put a heavy move on North Korea and end this nonsense once and for all." Hours earlier, China's UN ambassador Liu Jieyi, the current UN Security Council president, warned Korea tensions risk getting out of control.
Three things are essential: denuclearization, peace and security, peace and stability, and also negotiations and dialogue to seek solutions. Currently, tension is high, and we certainly would like to see de-escalation of tension, because if tension only goes up and goes up only, then sooner or later it will get out of control and the consequences would be disastrous. And I'm sure it is in our common interest to avoid anything like that.
The missile launch came as the United States marked its 241st Independence Day and just before the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, where President Trump is expected to meet his Chinese and Russian counterparts. David Wright of the Union of Concerned Scientists tells VOA's Victor Beatty it appears to have been the most powerful missile launch to date.
They did what they have done in recent launches, which is they've launched on a very, very high trajectory, almost straight up. So the range is not that long, and that's so that it will come down in the Sea of Japan without flying over Japan, which in the past has caused a lot of consternation in Japan. What the calculation that I did was to look at how far it flew before it splashed down and the flight time, and that told me that it flew very, very high. And then you can say how long would that same missile fly on a normal trajectory. And what you come up with, according to my calculations, is about 6,700 kilometers. Now, that's technically considered to be an intercontinental missile. The technical way people talk about an intercontinental range missile is anything over 5,500 kilometers. That range missile would allow North Korea to reach all of Alaska, but would not allow it to reach the lower 48 states or the main Hawaiian islands. But it is a considerable increase over missiles we've seen them launch before. And I think what it says is that North Korea is continuing to move forward with its ability to make longer and longer range missiles.
Well, David, based upon previous flights, is this considered a breakthrough?
I don't know if it's a breakthrough. I think it's basically sort of the stepwise progress you'd expect to see a country make. I think what's a little surprising about it is that it has been moving forward at a pretty rapid rate. It's had some failures, but it has had a number of successes that have gotten to longer and longer range. My sense is that unless something is done to stop the progress, sort of under business as usual, North Korea will be able to have a missile that can reach the continental United States in a relatively short time, a couple years anyway, and that basically what the United States has been doing in the past hasn't been working. Increasing sanctions are likely to put pressure on North Korea, but I don't think are going to stop the missile program. It's been clear, I think, even to the Trump administration that there are not good military options. We don't know where all the things are we'd like to hit, and any attack on North Korea would almost certainly lead to destruction of Seoul in South Korea. And so what that leads you to is to basically say that the United States really needs to engage North Korea at the negotiating table.
David Wright said China is not happy with North Korea's pursuit of nuclear and missile capability and is also unhappy the U.S. is ratcheting up its rhetoric, but is prepared to facilitate bilateral negotiations. The long-held U.S. position has been, first, a denuclearized Korean peninsula. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. North Korea missile test puts China on the spot. Putin and Xi call for North Korean freeze on missile tests. U.S. pivots back to hard line on China over disputed sea. Indian forces kill 3 rebels in Kashmir, 35 civilians injured. A watchdog says Chinese town is a major ivory smuggling hub. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and you'll find a whole lot more, too, when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and also stop by our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China this week opened its anticipated Bond Connect program in Hong Kong, linking its estimated $9 billion bond market with overseas investors, another step in internationalizing its capital markets and currency. The launch was timed to mark the 20th anniversary of the reversion of the territory, once a British colony, to Beijing's control. Carrie Lam is Hong Kong's new chief executive, her comments heard through a translator.
Bond Connect is a major breakthrough in the development of China's bond market. I expect it to become the most significant channel facilitating new international access and participation in China's interbank bond market and will enhance its price discovery and liquidity. Bond Connect represents another major step under our mutual market access program that began with Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connect in 2014 and the Shenzhen-Hong Kong Stock Connect last year. It further strengthens Hong Kong's position as an international financial center.
Qualified investors will be able to buy bonds in China. They are defined as central banks, sovereign wealth funds, and other major financial institutions. For now, it will be a one-way street. Economist Gary Hofbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics tells VOA this is part of China's assimilation with global markets, reflecting its growing global economic clout, and he explains why now.
Firstly, they want to show that the Chinese currency is truly a free-floating currency, and opening the bond market is a big part of having a freely floating currency because a lot of international financial flows go into and out of the bond market. I think the second reason is that they would like to see the RMB, the yuan, strengthened by inflows of capital seeking higher returns than they might get in other emerging markets and certainly that they might get in the U.S. or the Japanese or the European government bond markets. Most of the bonds are, of course, government bonds, but they're also corporate bonds on the Chinese market. And I think by this announcement, they will at least prompt some big pension fund investors, big exchange-traded funds, to buy more Chinese bonds than they otherwise had, because now the access is just very much easier than it was previously. So it's a major step.
Hofbauer tells how the new move is different from last year, when foreign investors in Hong Kong were allowed to trade shares of about 900 Chinese companies.
Both shares and bonds depend on credit rating agencies. And, of course, as part of the 100-day program, China opened the credit rating market to Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch's. So credit ratings will probably get better. The credit ratings on shares have always been a little bit questionable, and the financial reporting on shares is something that worries, let's say, outside investors. Bonds there's less to report on. I mean, they're important issues, but there's less dodginess in deciding whether bonds are amply secured or not. So it's a safer market by far than the share market, which in China tends to go up and down quite a bit. And you're more or less looking at the yield and then whatever the rating agencies say about the safety of the security, double A, single A, triple B, whatever it is. This will entice many investors who wouldn't think about buying Chinese shares or only buy a very small amount of Chinese shares. But Chinese bonds, they might be more willing to, you know, plunge heavily into those.
Gary Hofbauer said the market will also tend to stabilize the Chinese currency, the yuan or renminbi, putting it on the path to becoming the third major internationally traded currency alongside the euro and the dollar. He said the bond market program will also expose the Chinese economy to market forces. Happening now in Asia, three journalists remain detained in Myanmar, arrested last week after reporting in territory held by an outlawed rebel group in the northeast. They're charged under the Unlawful Associations Act, a colonial-era statute that could mean jail sentences of up to 3 years each. Their first hearing is July 11th. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us today on VOA Asia. Narendra Modi is the first Indian prime minister to visit Israel. He arrived Tuesday for a three-day visit. The two countries have had diplomatic relations for 25 years and have collaborated on counterterrorism issues, have close defense ties, and worked on joint agriculture, water, and energy projects. National University of Singapore India analyst Kanti Prasad Bajpai tells VOA the Indian leader's visit comes as his country embarks on a massive multi-billion dollar military modernization program.
Israel adds its own quite significant systems to existing Indian weapon platforms. So they're very good at, say, things like missiles and electronics of various kinds. So that's very useful for India. So overall, yeah, I mean, both from the political symbolic point of view as well as a more material set of benefits, it'll be a good visit.
Mr. Modi has no plans to meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, although they held talks in New Delhi in May, and not having a stop in Ramallah on the itinerary does not present an issue, in Bajpai's opinion.
No, not particularly surprising. I mean, I think India, particularly Mr. Modi, wants to make very clear that India-Israel relations must have their own logic, and he doesn't want to immediately have to go to the Palestine Authority and have to face maybe some awkward questions about India's relations with Israel and vice versa. So this just keeps it neater and cleaner and sends the message that India's Israel policy will have its own logic.
Professor Bajpai also commented on the sensitivity of Modi's visit to Arab neighbors along with Iran and possibly to the 180 million Muslims living in India.
I think the short answer is no to all of those. I think various Arab states do have diplomatic relations with Israel and have had relations going back much earlier. I mean, you had an Egyptian president who went to Israel famously many, many years ago. Of course, he tragically paid the price for it. There are extensive links between Arab countries and Gulf countries, other Muslim countries with Israel. So I think as far as other Muslim countries go and the Arab countries go, they know that India will strike out on its own. India has been careful to maintain good relations with Palestine at the same time. So I think India plays a fairly proper, balanced game there. Internally within India, I think Muslims in India have many other things to worry about, including the prospects of Hindu majoritarian rule, and they're much less worried about India's relationships with Israel. I don't think it'll be a big factor. No Muslim organization is going to make a very big issue out of this. They've got far more important things to worry about internally.
Kanti Prasad Bajpai said the visit not only boosts Israel's standing in the world, but also highlights the presence of some 100,000 Indian Jews in Israel. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The Hit List never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Russia, where he and Russian President Vladimir Putin agreed for a need on a freeze of North Korea's missile and nuclear programs, as well as large-scale joint military exercises by the United States and South Korea. As the big stories develop, follow them on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Climbers striving to reach the summit of the world's second-largest mountain, K2, have been challenged the past 2 years because of unusually harsh weather conditions and rock snow avalanches blamed on climate changes. But British-based American climber Vanessa O'Brien has not been deterred. The 52-year-old former business executive led attempts to scale K2 in 2015 and again in 2016, when an avalanche buried all of the expedition's equipment stashed at Camp 3, its highest altitude operational base. O'Brien is back in Pakistan this year to make a final attempt to conquer the 8,611-meter-tall K2 known as the Savage Mountain, which she described to reporters in Islamabad.
K2 is the perfect triangle. Mountains are not shaped that way. In reality, they're very peculiar, and they've got lots of places to rest and go higher and stop, and this is boom, a triangle. It's asking for 110% effort day one. You've got a lot of avalanches. You've got a lot of, because of climate change, you've got more rock, which used to be fixed to the earth and frozen, is now just, you know, broken and coming down like rock avalanches, which is causing its own accidents. So you've got the snow avalanches, you've got the rock avalanches, you've got extreme weather, unpredictable weather. So even if I know it, it could change on a dime. Any one of those three could kill the expedition at a moment's notice. So it's just fraught with danger. And that's probably why for every four that climb, one dies.
In 2008, 11 climbers died trying to scale K2, the worst accident in its history. Only 18 women have climbed K2, and O'Brien has climbed, among others, the world's highest peak, Everest. And if she reaches the summit of K2, she will be the first American woman to do so, weather permitting.
Given that we've had really good spring seasons elsewhere in the Himalayas, if anything, I think that's a good indicator for a better season here. We need to know that forecast to be in position at Camp 4, and what I really worry about are the winds, because most winds at the summit are about 100 kilometers an hour. I need those winds to be down around 40 kilometers an hour to really have a possible shot.
The mountaineers began their journey late last month, and they're currently in the process of getting used to the conditions at Camp 1 on K2. She appears confident with good conditions that her team will be able to scale up to Camp 4 and reach the summit very soon in mid-July. Developing at this hour in Asia, a group of influential U.S. senators has cautioned President Donald Trump that a military surge alone will not help win the war in Afghanistan, and they view as, quote, very unnerving, a lack of U.S. diplomatic focus on the issue. The five-member bipartisan delegation visited Kabul Tuesday. Share with your friends the latest stories and great features found every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, while technological revolution is changing much of the world, there's still areas that have seen only a very small benefit, or none at all. Places where people still live without electricity, clean water, and basic health care. Innovators presented affordable new devices at a competition recently held in Washington. VOA's George Pudich reports these devices were specially designed to help improve the lives of the world's poorest.
We often forget that in many parts of the world, people still prepare their daily meals in a highly inefficient and polluting way. But fires can burn more efficiently and with less smoke if they get enough oxygen. The stove, designed by BioLite, creates enough electricity to power a small built-in fan.
The fan force feeds oxygen onto the fire through these air jets, which are inside the combustion chamber. to make sure that there's enough oxygen in the fire where it's needed to completely combust the fuel and eliminate the smoke.
This invention was one of the three finalists in this year's competition organized by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, or ASME, which believes in promoting inventions that have a positive social or environmental impact.
ASME has 150,000 members around the world, so our key value and why we like working with these guys is because we can connect them to experts in the space that can help them on their journey of taking hardware to market.
Keeping food fresh in warm climate areas is another problem for people living without electricity. A low-cost collapsible cooler that runs on water was another prize-winning invention.
You open this flap and you put water inside, and the water comes down into the walls all around it. So the water sweats out from the fabric, and the net effect is the inside of the container, which is over here where you put your vegetables, becomes cold.
This year's competition also included a number of affordable medical devices aimed at addressing the lack of access to health care. Many poor countries do not have enough eye doctors to test all the patients with vision problems and prescribe correctional glasses. A portable device called QuickSee can measure a patient's diopter in seconds and does not require any special training to administer.
You simply have a patient look into the device for 10 seconds, you push a button, it measures their eye, and at the end, some numbers will be displayed, which are the same numbers that are used for an eyeglass prescription.
Each year, ASME holds similar events in India, Kenya, and around the U.S. At each location, winners share $30,000 and get help promoting their inventions to potential investors. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
At this hour, it remains July 4th here in the United States as celebrations are taking place to commemorate the 241st birthday of our country. It, of course, is a national holiday, and there are public festivities everywhere. The night sky soon will explode with fireworks. VOA's Arash Arabasadi asked people on the National Mall here in Washington if it's a happy birthday year for the nation and how they're celebrating.
Fireworks!
Fireworks, reminiscent of the war when Americans united, fought for the new nation's independence from Britain. Less than 6 months into President Donald Trump's administration, political issues and divisions are on many Americans' minds.
The president is very rough in his character, and we are not making peace right now between both parties, the Republican and the Democrats.
Trump is doing enough behind the scenes and getting things together, and more people are, I think, starting to see positives that are happening, and I hope that, you know, in a few years this whole nation starts getting together.
You got both sides, you know, battling, and things are good, you know, overall, for most Americans.
Independence Day is a celebration of the American dream.
Well, I believe the principles of a free nation still holds good, and here you have what you envision and what you endeavor, you can always accomplish. Well, that makes this nation so special.
I think this country at this moment is great, and it's very peaceful, and people really enjoy their life here.
When you look at the national opinion, people think that it is the country is not going well. But until they compare what is happening to the rest of the world, then they will know that the country is doing well.
In the end, America's birthday is a national holiday.
So I get a day off, so I'll take it as a happy birthday, a day off to relax. So, yeah.
I don't know about America. All I know is that I'm glad to be here. It's amazing food, an amazing place. I love the fireworks, the many things that we've created. I'm just glad to be here.
July 4th here is an outdoor party with a parade, bands, and, of course, fireworks. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and we'd like to say a special hello to everyone who's listening on Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And if you happen to run into the Faculty of Communication who run the radio station, give them a special thank you for being able to hear us. You can get our program via Helps Radio, iTunes, and SoundCloud. You can find us on our website at voanews.com. And, of course, we also stream on VOA Asia Facebook. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Dan Crafton, managing editor, Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day.